Nashua at 77 degrees, in Portsmouth 76, and in Whitefield 70. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Dartmouth College is now shining a light on a problem that has long cast a shadow over its campus, sexual assault. All this week, staff and students from Dartmouth and other institutions are gathering at a summit on sexual assault to learn about best practices for preventing rape on campuses and for handling these cases. And it's notable that this event is hosted by Dartmouth, one of about 60 colleges and universities under federal investigation for how they deal with complaints of rape, sexual harassment, and other crimes. The summit also comes as Dartmouth's new president finishes his first academic year, Philip Hanlon, a Dartmouth grad himself, who has spoken out frequently and sharply about his college being, as he puts it, hijacked by extreme behavior. President Hanlon is our guest today in The Exchange, and we'll talk about this week's summit as well as other priorities, including his focus on so-called experiential learning and his big plans for a $100 million anonymous gift the college has received, the largest in its history. Let's hear from you, too, this hour. Your questions for President Hanlon about Dartmouth and broader trends in higher education. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. And President Hanlon joins us by phone from Hanover. And President Hanlon, great to have you. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, in a speech this spring, a call to action, you named it, you spoke out strongly against what you called extreme behavior. And you said that much has changed since you graduated from Dartmouth more than three decades ago in 1977. But you said more has remained the same. What's the same, President Hanlon?
Well, first of all, let me say, you know, I took the last year reacquainting myself with Dartmouth. I've been away for quite a long time. And it's been an exceptional year. It's been a chance to talk to students, to faculty, to parents, to alumni. My wife and I met with over 3,100 students in small groups, over 500 faculty, thousands of alumni, and it's been terrific getting reacquainted with the college. And, you know, one of the things that jumps out as being the same is Dartmouth's exceptionalism. And, you know, I'd measure that first by outcomes. You know, what do we expect from Dartmouth? And if you look at nationwide, about 2 million people received undergraduate degrees over the last couple of months. 1,112 of those 2 million were at Dartmouth. So if you like math, as I do, then you'll realize that that's 0.05%. That's all. That's the fraction of graduates nationwide that were at Dartmouth. And yet, what we all know is that Dartmouth grads populate leadership positions, you know, very robustly. Four members of the U.S. Senate did their undergraduate work at Dartmouth. The Center for the World University Rankings just released its most recent global rankings of universities this morning. And one of the key inputs is the percent of alums who hold CEO positions at top companies, and Dartmouth scored very highly in that. Shonda Rhimes, our commencement speaker, is one of the great innovators in the entertainment industry. And one of our most recent graduates, Abby D'Agostino, she is second only to Mark Spitz in the number, in all sports, in all history, of the number of NCAA championships, national championships in Division I held by a single person. So in terms of outcomes, Dartmouth, with its small number of graduates, continues to place them in leadership positions. So that's not changed.
And you're talking about the exceptionalism, and for sure the institution's academic reputation is not in dispute. But what about this campus culture, President Hanlon, that you and others have spoken so strongly about?
Well,
Has that changed?
Yeah. Let me finish up, because I think that if you ask what leads this exceptionalism, and that refers to you know, the big scholarly ideas too. It's not just student outcomes. Dartmouth has been a place that, you know, takes on big opportunities in the world and big issues. And we just recently celebrated the 50th anniversary of BASIC. And BASIC was more than a computer language. It was an audacious idea that computing would come to all people. It wouldn't be just the domain of scientists and engineers. Jack Wenberg at the Dartmouth Institute here in the Geisel School of Medicine did the first studies of regional variations of healthcare costs, which has led over the years to our current approach to healthcare.
Right, and we've interviewed those folks.
Yeah,
a lot of work
idea.
Going on with that. Right.
Right. And so what are the features of Dartmouth that, you know, that remain the same that lead to these outcomes? And, you know, one I would say is it's still a small, tight-knit community, very, very tightly knit. Its location, the stunning, beautiful New Hampshire environment is and challenging environment teaches self-reliance. It's, you know, if you look at the very top colleges and universities in this country, no one has a setting like Dartmouth. The faculty's dedication to the undergraduate experience. You know, if you ask me why has U.S. News ranked Dartmouth as number one in undergraduate education for 5 years in a row, I would say it's the faculty's dedication to the experience. And then our incredibly talented and passionate students. Now, let me get to the question of what's different, and particularly in the social scene. And what's different is not just different for Dartmouth. It is different at all colleges and universities across the country. And this is a more complicated social scene than when I was in college. There's a lot more hard liquor being consumed on campuses nationwide. You know, that's what I hear from my presidential colleagues. Often is the pre-gaming that goes on before students even leave their residence halls. Many students are on or have access to prescription drugs. That was not something going on when we were in school. And I think you cannot underestimate the impact of IT and students having just access to unmediated, unfiltered content, some of which is very hateful, some is very distressing, so I think all of those things make for a much more complicated social scene than when we were students.
What do you hope comes out of this summit on sexual assault this week that you're hosting at Dartmouth College, President Hanlon? This is a big deal. It's going on all week at Dartmouth.
Yeah, so there's the issues around sexual assault and violence are ones that every college and university in this nation are grappling with. And so the idea behind the summit is to bring together the experts and practitioners from all the campuses. And it's not just to hear speeches. It's the real key part of the summit is the working groups, which will be going on in the next couple of days. And that's where the practitioners are able to get together with national experts on the topic and try to understand what's working on what campuses, what's not working, where do we have evidence? What are the best approaches? And so what I hope to come out of this is a series of recommendations for things that are actually working, a series of reports about steps that some campuses are trying that are having an effect. And then I hope we'll have a follow-up summit hosted by some institution, I don't know which one, to try to actually drill down on the most promising, successful approaches.
Well, and as I said in my introduction, Dartmouth is one of about 60 colleges and universities nationwide under federal investigation for how you deal with complaints of rape and sexual harassment. And you guys changed your policy about a month ago, now requiring an independent investigator look into complaints, expulsion in some cases. A couple questions. What was the complaint about the old system, President Hanlon? About how that led to this federal investigation.
The changes that we enacted are changes that are being considered by many places, and I think you may have read in the New York Times or the Boston Globe that Harvard more recently went the same direction with their judicial system. And I think some of the issues that arise are that when you use the traditional model of a student faculty panel, that the issues in a case of alleged sexual assault are extremely complex. The emotions run very high. It's very difficult sometimes for survivors to bring forward their stories in front of their peers and in front of faculty that maybe they may be working with. And so we've gone to a model where we're going to hire external investigators. Real experts who have done this kind of investigation work before, And so we feel that that will have a more rigorous outcome than
we've had. An independent investigator.
Yeah. That's right. In terms of the expulsion, we as you said, we mandate that in some cases, and it's always an option in every case. The question is, in the most extreme cases, we said we were even taking the judgment away from the panel, and we're just saying automatically you have to be expelled.
So the independent investigator works for the college. You said you're going to hire them. How do you keep this person free from political pressure, from families, from alumni, from college officials? How do you keep that person completely independent so they can do their best work?
Well, we're expecting to hire people who are highly experienced. For example, someone who has been a sex crimes investigator in a major city or something like that. So they're going to be well experienced and able to handle any kind of political pressure that might be brought to bear.
Is the expulsion piece new, President Hanlon?
The mandatory part is new.
And mandatory, but not in all cases. In some cases, depending on what happens with the investigator.
Yeah, there's a well-defined right.
Yeah. Have you gotten any feedback from that? That's pretty tough. Expulsion.
Well, we posted the policy, the draft policy, for public comment, and we got quite a lot of comment on it, and mostly positive.
All right. I want to let our listeners know that we are taking your questions and comments to this hour with President Philip Hanlon. He's the president of Dartmouth College. As I said, he just finished out his first academic year at the Ivy League school. We're taking your questions and comments either about Dartmouth itself, especially if you're a Dartmouth grad, we'd love to hear from you, or about trends in higher education in general that you have probably heard us talk about before, whether it's affordability, diversity, access, online education. We'll cover all those issues and more with President Hanlon in just a moment. I invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your source for New Hampshire news and so much more. Click over right now and read Word of Mouth's guide to summer bird watching in the Granite State. Keep an eye on what's new in New Hampshire all day at NHPR.org. We have a flash flood watch in effect for most of the state through tomorrow evening. Showers and scattered thunderstorms for today. Some may have gusty winds, heavy rainfall, and small hail. Highs from mid-70s to the lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Nathan Wexler & Company, professionals working together as a team to provide businesses and nonprofits comprehensive accounting and tax solutions, offices in Concord and Lebanon. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth presenting the HD broadcast of Driving Miss Daisy, starring James Earl Jones and Angela Lansbury, July 19th at 3:30 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with the president of Dartmouth College, Philip Hanlon, as he just wrapped up his first academic year at the school. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And President Hanlon, some emails are coming in already, and here's one from Susan, who says, when will Dartmouth conduct its own campus climate survey? And given the very nature of openness and accountability in a community, in its own form of prevention, will that unedited data be made public? If not, please explain why not. Now, she opens this by talking about the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault and the summit that you guys are hosting this week. What about that idea of a campus climate survey? There has been a lot written, President Hanlon, as you know, about the climate at Dartmouth.
Well, so I have committed to conducting a campus climate survey, and the White House Task Force then added to that momentum. And one thing that we realized with my colleagues my other presidents, is that we really should be producing an instrument that all campuses use, or that many campuses use, so that we can not only test the climate on our own campuses, but also try to compare, you know, our situation to other situations. And what's going on right now is that representatives from many universities are actually convening to try to determine, is there an instrument that we all want to use together?
Yes, Susie says the White House Task Force, as well as experts at your summit this week, are looking at the role of campus culture, institutions in sexualized violence. She says UNH has been cited by the White House Task Force as national leaders. Sounds like a good partner for Dartmouth in such a project. Susie, thank you for the email. I did want to ask you a little bit more about climate. President Hanlon, we did a show earlier this year on the Greek system, and including some of the issues that have come up on fraternities on Dartmouth's campus, not just Dartmouth, but we did talk about that. How much do you connect this campus culture problem, if we could call it that, sexual assaults, the drinking that you mentioned, and other issues, with the Greek system? Is it a strong connection or not?
So, Laura, I'm really interested in behaviors. I'm interested in eliminating extreme and harmful behaviors wherever they occur on campus. And we know that, in fact, they occur in every site where students socialize on campus. And, you know, the residence halls I mentioned earlier, pre-gaming in the residence halls is a national issue that campuses are struggling with. So I'm really focused on the behaviors.
So whether that's occurring in the residence halls or off campus or in the fraternities and sororities, you're saying focus on the behavior.
Yeah. Or online, Laura. Don't forget that.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And you were a member of fraternity yourself while you were at Dartmouth, right?
I was.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So how does that sort of shape your feelings about some of the critique that comes out towards the Greek system?
You know, I bring many experiences to my job as president. I bring my experiences as a student here, both my academic and social background, but also my experiences as a parent. I have three wonderful children who are who were recently in college themselves. I bring my my experience as a scholar who's committed to rigor and evidence. I bring my experience as a teacher who really respects what the practitioner brings to us. I bring my experience as an academic leader. So all those experiences are shaping the way that I think about things.
Here's an email that came in from Lori. She says, as a former executive director of a national fraternity, I occasionally wonder if there are any college presidents who invite fraternity leaders to introduce freshmen to the real meaning and value of fraternities. And I should let you know, President Hanlon, that when we did our show on Greek culture, our calls were split 50-50. You know, a lot of people did talk about the value of fraternities. Can you just broadly address Lori's point there, please, President Hanlon?
Well, I think that, you know, I would put it in the framework of student organizations. And I think that student organizations inevitably have, you know, many good things to teach students about leadership, about working as teams, about working together, about having shared objectives. You know, one of our most, I think, compelling experiences for freshmen are freshman trips, which are put on by students, by the Dartmouth Outing Club, which takes students out for several days, hiking, canoeing, climbing, biking. There's lots of different ways to do that. I think that, you know, fraternities, sororities, senior societies, they're all types of student organizations. They have positive things to add and, you know, some negative behaviors, too. So I don't, you know, in terms of freshmen, I don't know quite what the question's asking about introducing students to that, but I think that's what I'd say about student organizations.
Thanks again for that email, Lori, and for the other one, Susan. The number here on the exchange for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And let's go to our listeners, our callers, if we could, President Hanlon. And this is Victoria in Lebanon, right in your backyard. Hi, Victoria. You're on the exchange.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
So yeah, I am a Dartmouth graduate, class of 2010. And
congratulations.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations, Victoria.
And, so welcome, President Hammond. And I just wanted to ask that as a student, I always noticed that there was a lot of attention to the victims of sexual assault, but not a lot towards a lot of focus on the victims and on the fraternities, but not a lot of focus on the perpetrators, the people who committed it, and they didn't seem to have a chance to either learn from what had happened themselves so they wouldn't commit sexual assault again, or a chance to redeem themselves or some form of remediation. And there didn't seem to be a lot of focus on the role sororities played in having their doors closed to freshman girls so that freshman year, the freshman girls are just funneled right into the fraternity system in a way where it just is kind of an attitude of what do you expect is going to happen if you have a bunch of drunk girls in a male-dominated space.
So 2 points, Victoria, then. Let me make sure I've got you right. One is maybe putting people into the Greek system too young, too early. Is that your second point there?
Possibly. It's also, it just seems that the freshman year, I think that this is a national sorority rule, they aren't allowed to have their doors open to people who aren't sorority members, whereas the fraternities do have their doors open.
I see
so
what you're saying.
So as a freshman girl, you go into a male-dominated space, but you're not allowed to go into a female-dominated space.
So, but the broader point you were making, Victoria, is about, you know, the perpetrators of sexual violence and whether there's enough attention on rehabilitation, sort of getting them to figure out, you know, what they did wrong and so forth. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so just, you know, my brother was a prosecutor of sexual assault crimes, and most of the time it's repeat offenders.
Huh.
You know, and it's just on the campus, there's really a huge lack of awareness of what consent is. You know, people thinking that, well, if she doesn't say no, then it's okay, versus like an affirmative yes.
Got it. Yes. And the new policy that you put out, President Hanlon, in June talks about this whole consent issue. Can you just briefly address what Victoria is saying?
Yeah. So I think let me talk about the point she's making about sororities, because I think there's a broader point here that's really important. And that is that one of the very few methods to prevent sexual assault approaches that has been shown through research to work is broad-based community mobilization. So in other words, this cannot be, you know, just that the president has to stop this or that the administration has to stop this. This is a university, a community responsibility to prevent sexual assault. And everyone has their roles. The president has a role, the administration has a role, but students have roles too. Faculty have roles, alumni, parents. So, you know, that is the philosophy behind the bystander initiative. You mentioned UNH earlier. UNH is one of the pioneers of bystander training and that approach. Dartmouth put together its own Dartmouth Bystander Initiative, which launched over a year ago. The idea here is to try to train students who will be informed bystanders so that they can try to identify when there's a perpetrator who's possibly aimed at a sexual assault. And this comes to Victoria's second point. So that's just an instance of community mobilization. And Victoria's quite right. The research shows that nationally that a preponderance of sexual assaults are committed by a few serial perpetrators. And so that was part of the logic behind the mandatory expulsion. That's also part of the logic behind the bystander approach. And, you know, we're taking the bystander approach to the next level. In the fall, we're opening a Center for Community Action and Prevention, whose mission is to find ways to activate the entire community, as I said, not just students, not just administration, but faculty, parents, alumni, staff, in how to prevent sexual assault.
Thanks a lot for the call, Victoria. Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us with Dartmouth President Philip Hanlon is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Well, President Hanlon, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the $100 million anonymous gift that Dartmouth got sometime, I believe, earlier this year. the biggest gift ever. An anonymous donor who said he or she was giving it because they wanted to help you out. What was your reaction when this came through the door?
Well, needless to say, I was thrilled. I was moved. This particular donor has been very successful. That's obvious, but also credits his Dartmouth education as being fundamental towards his success. One of the first items of business for me this year was to actually speak, as I said, to a lot of members of the community, faculty, students, alumni, and read through the strategic planning efforts that had been done over the prior few years, and to put together a vision for the future of the college. And that's a vision which I shared with the faculty on November 4th at a faculty meeting, along with a set of strategies to move us towards that vision. And I think it was that vision and the approach which really motivated this particular donor to reach out and say, yes, that is the vision I want for Dartmouth, and I'm willing to step up to help.
So for those outside the Dartmouth community listening to us today, just give us a broad sense of what that vision is and
sure.
where some of the big chunks of this money will go.
Sure. So the vision itself really has three pillars. The first is talent. So we want the very best students in the world to choose Dartmouth because of the amazing training they have to become leaders in the world. I was mentioning some of the outcomes earlier. But also the chance to work closely with outstanding faculty. Some of the best faculty will choose Dartmouth because of the amazing research going on campus and the chance to work with these students, these outstanding students. So talent is the first pillar. The second is very important. So I want this campus to be one that's intellectually energized, that's alive with innovation, with bold ideas, with intellectual risk-taking, being willing to really take on some of the world's biggest challenges and opportunities. And the reason that's so important for a place like Dartmouth is because of our scale. So if you look at a large major public research university that's doing research at such a scale and across such a breadth that it can just move the ball incrementally and make a big impact on the world. Dartmouth is at a much smaller scale, which means we need the home run ideas. We need the really out-of-the-box, creative, bold thinking. And so I want a campus that's alive with that kind of innovation. And then the third pillar is that I want every member of the community involved in these efforts to better the world on campus. And so that faculty and grad professional students are pretty much automatically, so that means our undergraduates. And so I want the undergraduate experience to be one that's characterized by artistic and creative works, by undergraduate research efforts, by taking ideas into action through social ventures and business startups.
So really, the quality of a Dartmouth education is already up there, but it sounds like enhancing that quality even more.
Absolutely, taking us to the next level. So that's the vision part. Then I also at the same speech talked about some initial strategies to move us there, and these included a faculty hiring initiative where we're going to hire faculty around an area of impact rather than around by academic discipline. So just to give you an example of that, one of the proposals is that we hire a set of faculty who are interested in the question of how we advance the Western Hemisphere. So if you think about the Western Hemisphere, it's a very interesting place. It has some of the world's strongest and some of the world's weakest economies. It has some of the greatest disparities in the world. It has rich cultures throughout. It has a history of problematic transnational relationships. So if you were to hire a set of faculty who share an interest in the topic of advancing the Western Hemisphere, you would be picking one probably from business, one from government, one from Latino and Caribbean studies, one from public health. That's one of the ideas is to hire this faculty hiring initiative. Experiential learning you mentioned earlier. We're in a world where new IT platforms can deliver information and knowledge essentially free of charge to your laptop. So we're at a time when if you want to learn about Walt Whitman, or you want to learn about artificial intelligence, or you want to learn about quantum mechanics, you're going to be able to open your laptop. You're going to be able to download lectures by the finest faculty at Dartmouth and MIT and Stanford. And so what that says is that if information and knowledge are now somehow becoming a free public good, the real value added of a place like Dartmouth, of the elite colleges and universities and their education, is really what I'll call wisdom, the skills to succeed in the world.
Not just information, right. So that's where the experiential learning comes in. Students get out, they put their hands on it, and they work with it. A lot of folks have been doing that for a while. Northeastern in Boston comes to mind. That's famous for its co-op model. How far does Dartmouth go this route, given where you are in the world? You know, you're kind of in that beautiful little enclave there in Hanover.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that attracted me about Dartmouth is the extent to which we do this in very creative ways already. So just one example is something called the Rocky Policy Shop. And so this is run by our Rockefeller Center. And what it does is it mounts a course about state government. And then the following term, students actually go work in the legislatures in Vermont and New Hampshire. And they work as, doing staff-type work. They produce policy briefs. They testify before committees. So that's really quite an amazing transformative experience. Another one that I'll mention is the Pagnucci Fellows, which is run by the Tuck Business School for undergraduates. And each year they take a set of undergraduates and they look at an international service provider, sort of someone who serves, who an organization which helps the underserved, and provides them first of all, it teaches the students about this type of organization and then takes them on the road. And so last year they went down to, I think it was Venezuela, and they looked at a microfinance organization and tried to help them understand how they could generate more customers.
So it's there. And with 424 state lawmakers here in New Hampshire, no shortage of office holders for students to work with. I got some more questions for you, President Hanlon, after a short break. And we'll take more of your calls and emails. The number 1-800-892-6477. We'll talk about college affordability and some other subjects with President Hanlon coming up.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, soaring natural gas production, new pipelines, and private property rights. Then internet billionaire Nick Hanauer on why America's 1%ers must do more to close the wealth gap. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Ansel and Anderson, Trust and Estate Attorneys in Bedford, helping clients with thoughtful planning for all the transitions of your life on the web at anslpa.com. And the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, creating eco-friendly and healthy sleep environments, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're speaking with Dartmouth President Philip Hanlon about issues specific to his campus and about higher education in general. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like as well. And President Hanlon, we were talking about some of your plans for this big $100 million anonymous gift that came in. You talked about expanding experiential learning. You talked about bold thinking, attracting the very best students, and so forth. What about the cost of a Dartmouth education? Would some of this money go toward reducing that price tag?
Yeah, so let me talk about that, because that's a, I think, major issue for higher education in the U.S. right now. And, if you were to ask me, I would predict that the period ahead of us, the next couple of decades, is one where higher ed in the U.S. is going to change substantially. And that's because it's being pressed by by multiple forces. One is IT and the impact of IT. One is globalization. One is the nature of world issues and their complexity. But the last is that the funding model for higher education is unsustainable and probably near the breaking point. If you look at the top colleges and universities and the non-resident tuitions at the top state universities, they're exceeding $60,000 a year for cost of attendance. And, you know, that exceeds the median household income in this country. So we've gotten to a point where I really don't think that we can continue on the path we've been on.
So a lot of people would agree with you there. So what do you do about it?
Yeah, so let's talk about the path we've been on. Let's talk about why we're on that path and then what we're doing about it at Dartmouth. And so the path we've been on is that across higher education, cost of attendance has grown in excess of the rate of inflation by 2 to 3% a year for about 40 years in a row, something like that. And so that's why we've got the outcome we have. Now, why is that? And I think it's helpful to just start and say, what should be the rate of inflation for college costs?
Should it be the same as the inflation rate in the society in general?
Yeah, I'm about to answer it.
Yeah.
So if you think about a college or university, most of our costs are people. And so you would expect whatever index you like for increases in total compensation. That should be the approximate inflation rate if Dartmouth was to do the same things next year we do this year. Now, why are we 2 to 3% above that? Why have we been 2 to 3% above it for 40 years in a row as a nation? And one reason is need-based financial aid. So in other words, the sticker price goes up more than the net price because some of the revenue is diverted to provide financial aid for those with need. There's pretty convincing evidence that I've seen, including by Richard Vedder, which says that accounts for a little less than 1% of that 2 to 3%. And so what's the remaining 1 to 2%? And so in my mind, it's the way that higher ed has chosen to handle innovation. So we have to innovate. We're the ultimate innovation organization. We have to be teaching new subjects. We have to be teaching in new ways. We have to do research on new subjects. We need facilities, new kinds of facilities to do that. And what we have been allowed to do because of all the demand is we've been allowed to add the cost of innovation to the sticker price. So we've innovated by addition. So other organizations, or you and your household, would more likely innovate through substitution. So you'd say, okay,
or subtraction.
In other words, what's the least important stuff I'm doing?
Sure.
How can I stop doing it so I can do this new
thing? Right.
So that is a practice that I brought with me from my prior job and introduced at Dartmouth this year. I required all of our units units meaning like arts and sciences, engineering, Tuck School, the plant department, and so on, to explicitly identify 1.5% of their spend that they would stop doing and how they would put that into an innovation that they wanted to do.
So are you saying colleges need to be more lean and mean, to use a sort of worn-out phrase? Or
So, I mean, in this case that I just described, in our case this year, we put together a budget that has robust investment in innovation and excellence and the lowest tuition increase since 1977. And so we will continue that practice. And, by the end of 10 years, we'll have reallocated 15% of our budget from lower priority things to things of lower effectiveness, or we'll find ways to be more efficient and put that into the innovation.
Wow, it's a big change, 15%. So you mentioned financial aid, and that's, of course, hugely important to especially middle-class families. From what I understand, President Hanlon, if you're low income and you have great grades and you're a great student, you can pretty much go to Dartmouth for free, right?
Dartmouth has a very generous financial aid program. At least certainly much more generous than my previous experience. There is very significant financial aid offered for families that certainly have family income below $100,000 and even up financial aid offered up to $150,000 as well. So I think our average debt for students who graduate with debt is about $13,000.
Which isn't that much compared to the rest of the country. Is that correct?
It's much lower than the national average. Yes,
so, right. Again, getting back to the cost of financial aid and so forth and the gift, there was an article in the Dartmouth, which is your student newspaper, talking about the big gift coming in and congratulations and saying, I'm quoting here, money is flowing into the college at a dizzying rate, making the so-called Dartmouth experience more valuable than ever. And you talked about that, bringing in the talent and so forth. But this writer said the only thing being forgotten is the students who have to pay for it. So again, I'm just trying to speak for the students here who are concerned about the cost, and I'm just wondering if the financial aid is going to go up even more as a result of this big gift.
Well, so, the big gift by donor intent is for academic excellence.
I see. You have to follow the intent of the donor. Yeah, go ahead.
But, Laura, let me point out that in the same budget where our cost of attendance went up by 2.9% this year, our financial aid budget did go up 5.9%, so well above the cost of attendance growth. And so, in fact, our net cost will be dropping. There is more financial aid being made available than the actual increase in cost.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And President Han, let's go back to our callers. And Chelsea's in New London. Hi, Chelsea. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
So I'm just wondering about Dartmouth's either current relationship with their local crisis centers or their plan to have a relationship, because I know that crisis centers have been providing support around domestic and sexual violence for decades and have a lot of experience supporting survivors and also implementing prevention programs. And so I'm wondering about your plans for establishing a relationship with your local crisis center.
Yeah, the local crisis centers do have a great reputation, Chelsea, for helping victims out. Do you want to address that, President Hanlon, very briefly? I know, again, you issued a new policy in June, so, yeah.
Yeah, and Chelsea, I would agree with you that, local crisis centers do have a great reputation, and as Laura noted, and, I think I would say any tools that we can use effectively to help reduce the incidence of sexual assault or better serve the survivors, we're anxious to try. Exactly how we are working with local crisis centers is actually something that our dean of the college handles in their office. So, but I would say, you're absolutely right, and we're anxious to do whatever we can, use whatever tools we can.
Was that part of the new policy that you folks put out in June?
I don't remember it being part of the policy, but it may have been. But I think again, the dean of the college area is anxious to work with whatever organizations, whatever tools they can, to make sure that we respond well to survivors and support them.
Chelsea, thanks for the call. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Getting back to the issue of talent, President Hanlon, you talked about wanting to bring the very best students in the world to Dartmouth. Two questions there, if I could. One is, I read that there's a drop in applications at Dartmouth, 14% for the class of 2018. What's your thought on that, and what are your plans for boosting those applications again?
Yeah, great question. And I think what's important is to look at the admission cycle this year, because it was, to say the least, quite an unusual year. So a roller coaster is perhaps the right word for it.
Wow, so what's going on?
We began with early decision applications being up significantly. They were up about 7%. We had a fabulous early decision class that came in. Then, as you noted, regular decision apps were down 14%. And I'll come back to what we know about that. But then at the end of the day, the yield, which is the percent of students who we admitted who put down deposits to come, jumped by 6%, which is in yield terms unbelievable, to the highest level ever in history at Dartmouth. So we had the highest yield ever. So of the students we admitted, the number who decided to come, that fraction was the highest in history. We ended up with a a truly remarkable class. On May 4th, when all the dust had settled, we saw, jumps in all of the academic credentials. We saw the most diverse class we've seen in quite a while. So, so as I said, it was kind of an up, a down, an up type year on the admissions front. We ended up over-enrolled for the year. So what do we know about the admissions drop, the application drop? So we did survey what we call non-applicants. So those are students who had either visited campus and then chose not to apply, or else has sent us their test scores and chose not to apply. And we asked them what were their reasons for not applying. And the top five reasons in order was number one, that they were afraid they would not be admitted. Number two was the cost, or at least what they perceived the cost to be. Number three was they thought they would not fit in at Dartmouth. Number four was the location. And number five was concerns about the Greek life and the social scene.
So you're saying, you know, a lot of people said, hey, 14% drop, it's because of the problems with, you know, drinking and sexual assault and so forth. You're saying it's a concern, but it's not the number one overriding concern.
I'm just telling you factually what we found in our survey.
Yeah. What do they mean, I'm afraid I wouldn't fit in at Dartmouth? I wonder what that means.
I don't know. It's, you know, it could mean many things. It is a bit of a vague term. I was at an alumni event, and I had a mother who came up to me afterwards, and she said that her son had gone to Dartmouth and had a great experience. But none of her daughters would apply to Dartmouth because when they visited, everyone was outdoors, everyone was exercising, everyone was active, and that was just not their thing. They didn't think they'd fit in. So, you know, it could mean any number of things.
I wonder what you would say, President Hanlon, to the parents of daughters especially. We know sexual assault happens to men, but more of a concern for young women. And there have been, you know, some things on the internet saying, hey, young women, before you go to Dartmouth, think twice because of this, you know, problem with sexual assault. What would you say to those parents and to those young women who, you know, are a little worried about the reputation?
Yeah, so what I'd say is that, you know, Dartmouth is clearly a national leader in taking on this issue. We're open. We've been upfront about it. And I think the most important thing I would say to them is that sexual assault and violence is a major issue on every campus. You should not be worried if a campus is talking about it and working on it. You should be worried if a campus is not talking about it.
Here's an email that just came in. This person says, please share your thoughts on middle-class families trying to send their children to college. I have a daughter who wants to be a teacher. She will graduate high school with a B average, not a varsity athlete. Both parents are very well educated, but we wonder if she'll drop out of the middle class by getting an education. The salary of a school teacher will not justify over $100,000 in loans. We had someone call in earlier, too, who couldn't stay on the line, who had a similar question. President Hanlon, the idea that some college degrees are so expensive, you graduate with so much debt, you're trying to help people out by being a school teacher, and you can't pay it off. You know, people are making choices based on the debt loads that they carry. It's a big issue that we've talked about in this program a lot.
Yeah, I don't dispute that nationally, on the national scene, you know, the level of debt is certainly a concern. It's been rising. It's I believe the average is around $30,000 for students who have debt.
Wow, $30,000—that's
like
that. A lot.
It is a lot. I certainly would not want to diminish that amount of debt as a graduate. However, you know, it's important to look at you know, the real data about unemployment rates for students who have only a high school degree versus a bachelor degree, the average income for a high school only versus bachelor, the return on investment average, and, you know, all of those indicators still show that a college degree is way, way, way worthwhile. As the saying sometimes goes, that you've probably heard, the only anything more expensive than getting a college degree, maybe not getting a college degree.
Mm, right. Well, I appreciate the call, and it is an issue. Excuse me, the
email.
It
is, absolutely. And yeah. I don't want to diminish it. And I certainly applaud anyone who goes into teaching. Teaching is so important for our nation right now.
President Hanlon, speaking of teachers and at the high school level, Dartmouth decided recently not to accept AP courses as, you know, paid for, fully credited college courses. Some other colleges are making this choice as well. Parents are dismayed because this is a great way to save some money on those college credits. Where do you come down on this, whether to accept AP placement courses or not?
Well, you know, that's really a faculty matter. And, you know, I trust the faculty at the end of the day to make the right decisions on whether the, you know, what is rigorous enough training to count for towards a Dartmouth credit.
Yeah, that's the idea. That has to be college level rigorous enough to qualify
and
for that.
One thing I will say is, you know, I teach third semester calculus. I taught it last fall here. I'm going to teach it again next fall. And it is one tough course, I will tell you. It is rigorous. It is fast-moving. It is really difficult.
President Hanlon, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for giving us an hour of your day. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Laura.
That's Dartmouth President Philip Hanlon talking about the changes and challenges at Dartmouth College during his first academic year. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our interns are James Pouliot and Renee Taylor. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the latest astronomical news with our sky guys. NASA is in troubleshooting mode as the Mars rover Curiosity shows signs of wear after 2 years of roaming the planet. A global scientific body invites the public to vote on names for newfound planets. And astronomers are looking back 45 years ago when Apollo 11 made the first ever lunar landing. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next to 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and the City of Claremont. Information about Claremont's investments in sustainable growth at ClaremontNH.com. And TransCanada relicensing three existing hydroelectric stations on the Connecticut River to provide renewable energy, property and business taxes, and good jobs for the next generation.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Production of natural gas in this country has been soaring, but many of the pipelines needed to get the gas where it's needed have yet to be built. A recent industry-funded study estimates more than 300,000 miles of new infrastructure